This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
There's a widespread hostility towards ICE, I think similar to what people saw in Chicago, from wide breadth of the population of people of all nationalities and ethnicities.
As more ICE agents move into Minneapolis, workers organize to defend their communities.
It's really a political struggle because leadership is under the dominance of Peronism, and Peronism doesn't want people on the streets. People on the streets in Latin America and in Argentina too may ignite anti-colonialist sentiment that is in conflict with the deals they also defend.
Is Trump's attack on Venezuela an attack on all of the Latin American working class? We'll hear a view from Argentina.
Every vaccine is still available. Anybody who wants to get any of the vaccines that have previously been recommended are still available, and they will still be covered by insurance. But now, instead of having all of these vaccines being pushed on almost all children by pediatricians, they really won't be pushing the same number of vaccines on kids. And for high-risk groups or for the sort of more tangential vaccines that were basically only added in the last 15 years, it'll be shared decision-making.
Major changes to the childhood vaccine schedule signal recognition that the science has been lacking or ignored for decades. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. As ICE increases its presence in Minneapolis, Communication Workers of America President Kieran Knutson and members of his local are defending immigrant communities. In conversation with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer, he reports on the recent ICE killing of legal observer Renee Good.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica, and we've been covering the situation of workers, trade unions and the people, immigrants in Minneapolis with the occupation of the ICE. And joining us today is Kieran Knutson. He is president of CWA 7250 in Minneapolis. Welcome to our show, Kieran.
Thank you for having me.
So Kieran, maybe you can give a report on what's going on in Minneapolis, what's happening with the ICE, how it's affecting workers, immigrants, and your members right now in Minneapolis.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible situation. There is what I understand and what's being reported as the largest ICE deportation operation ever happening in Minneapolis and in the broader Twin Cities and in the state of Minnesota. And I believe that there's reports that there are 2,000 ICE agents in Minnesota. Report the other day of another 100 being moved from Chicago to the Twin Cities, along with all of their supposedly non-lethal weapons. And there is just constant ICE activity on the streets of Minneapolis. There's both organized raids against, targeted raids against workplaces and individuals who they clearly have on some list. And there's also random kidnappings, basically people being stopped because of their ethnicity. And, you know, being pulled out of their car, you know, while they're pumping gas at the gas station, or, you know, bringing their kids to daycare, those kinds of things. So it's this kind of incredibly intense campaign of terror, really. So both my sons speak Spanish and, you know, have a lot of friends and social scene in the Latino community and are helping out neighbors with getting groceries and stuff. But their experience and what lots of other people tell me is that there's just lots of immigrant workers who work and then just lock down, don't leave their house or apartment. You know, just don't risk going outside at all except for work. And many people aren't even going to work. Another friend of my son's mom lived in an apartment building that ICE was targeting, supposedly looking for the janitor in that building. And most of the folks in the apartment building are immigrants. And so everybody was, you know, there's ICE up and down through the hallways. And so people were just locking in their apartments for days, fearing to go outside at all. And so that's kind of going on a mass scale. But there's also a bunch of resistance that I think is really important as well.
And part of that resistance apparently was this woman, this activist who was videotaping and then was, I would say, assassinated, murdered. Is this really the kind of thing we're going to see in other places?
I mean, it seems like it, unfortunately, that a report came out about sort of the guidance that ICE agents have been given, and I'd just say that they've been basically given an extremely long leash and told that the feds have complete confidence in their decision making, and that they should take decisive action if they feel threatened at all. And so Renee Nicole Good was a volunteer anti-ICE observer, is my understanding, which there's a massive network, I think similar to the networks that were built in Chicago and other places, that I've read or heard that 10,000 people in the Twin Cities have been trained by one of the immigrant rights groups in sort of ICE monitoring. There are signal loops that involve thousands of, I've heard from 80 different neighborhoods in the metro area have their own specific anti-ICE watch text loops. So there is this incredible, and the mobilizations have been huge. There was a union organized march down Lake Street, which is sort of one of the main corridors in the south side of the city. A lot of immigrant businesses and people that live near Lake Street, organized by the unions and some of the No Kings type groups, and it drew upwards of 10,000 people a couple weeks ago on a very, very cold day. The vigil for Renee Nicole Good was massive. Thousands of people came out, on a few hours' notice. There's a huge rally planned for today by one of the immigrant rights groups in the south side of Minneapolis that I assume will draw, thousands and possibly tens of thousands of people. So there's a widespread hostility towards ICE, I think similar to what people saw in Chicago, from wide breadth of the population of people of all nationalities and ethnicities.
And the President Trump has said that Somalis are the enemy. Black Somalis are the enemy, and targeted them, and that they should be thrown out of the country. Do you think we're moving towards a fascist state? Do we have a fascist state? And what do you think should be the response of labor to the kind of direct attacks on working people?
So I'll just say a couple of things. First, Somali people, the Somali community is an integral part of the culture of the Twin Cities and of the working class of the Twin Cities. And the Somali people have made the Twin Cities a better place to be and have made the working class here stronger and more confident and more sophisticated in their understanding of the world. So Somali people are represented in a number of unions. Somali people, there's a lot of political sophistication in that community. There's a lot of self-organization in that community. And a lot of, for instance, during the uprising against George Floyd, Somali young people were one of the components of the uprising that made that happen. And so I think that they're targeted. Obviously, it's a racist targeting. It's full of lies and just a total lie about the role of Somalis in the Twin Cities. But it's also sort of not irrational if, from their point of view, they want to target one of the more sort of militant, organized, self-organized working class communities in the Twin Cities and try and divide that community and terrorize that community against the rest of the, population. But I don't think it's working. I think that people see through it. I think the Somali community has built a lot of alliances with unions, community groups, churches, mosques, synagogues, so that people have stepped up to call it out for what it is. To your question about fascism, I don't like to throw around that term loosely, I'll say it's qualitatively different than anything I've seen before. And I've been active in, social movements since I was a teenager. And it's the state is operating at another level, and some of the things that, we used to sort of assume in kind of a, bourgeois settler colonial democratic state, that the state would respond to sort of popular outrage by, moving, you know, co-opting or stepping back, retreating on certain questions if the population was mad enough. And it's just quite clear that, you know, the Trump regime is extremely committed to these policies, which are openly white supremacist and just, you know, terroristic in their methods. So I don't blame people. I don't know how important it is to decide exactly if it's fascist or not. I mean, I think it looks enough like it, and it has some qualitative differences than the way that they've ruled in the past that we need to adjust ourselves to those new realities, certainly. And I think that a lot of lessons from anti-fascist struggles apply here as well.
What are those lessons?
I mean, I think number one is we have to build a sort of self-reliant community defense structure, you know, that we can't sort of hope that the legal system or the politicians are going to protect people. It's just not happening. And anybody who puts a lot of faith in that, in those institutions, are kidding themselves and are wasting time and resources and energy and hope in that direction. I think we have to fundamentally build organizations that are controlled by our communities, by working class communities, by working class organizations, and where there can be, you know, strategic discussion and debate and decisive action, unified action as needed. And I think there's a basis for that, actually. I think this mass neighborhood ICE watch is one of those. I think that the community defense groups that still exist from the George Floyd uprising are another element. I think the unions, which are stepping up, and I think, or a number of them are stepping up, I should say, and are discussing things, you know, things that used to never be on the table except in amongst, you know, far left groups are now being discussed, you know, by unions in terms, you know, things like a political strike against what's happening. I think those discussions are going to increase because people see it as the only way to push back. So there's a logical, rational reason, not just an ideological one, for taking those kinds of actions. I think we have to really, you know, I don't know if people saw, but the mayor, you know, did a one-liner about ICE should get the f*** out of Minneapolis. The governor came on to denounce the murder and talk about activating the National Guard. And I think sometimes people are projecting hopes that that means that the National Guard will be brought out to protect Minnesotans from ICE, or that the mayor is serious about trying to do something to get ICE out. But neither of those things are true. The National Guard is not an institution that's controlled by us. It's been used against labor countless times. It was used during the uprising to try and suppress the uprising, and also brought out again when Dante Wright was killed in a Minneapolis suburb a year after George Floyd was. So I think it's a mistake to have any kind of faith in those institutions, and we have to build up our own networks of resistance, and we have to be willing to fight. I mean, I think it's extremely dangerous times, and we're not equipped yet for what this fight looks like, but we need to get so quickly. You know, just on a street protest level, you know, there've been another element I should mention is that there've been some good actions against the sort of headquarters building of where ICE stages from, a federal building near the airport. And, you know, ICE is just, again, they just another level up from what your typical experience is with even like riot police. They are just, you know, spraying gas immediately. You know, someone yells at them, they'll gas you. You keep yelling at them, they'll start shooting at you with these pepper pellets, or shooting tear gas canisters or rubber bullets. And so, you know, it's just a whole another level that I don't think that we're ready for, but we're getting ready for. We have to.
It sounds like an occupation. And actually, in Chicago, the mayor, Brandon Johnson, called for a general strike.
Yeah, I heard that. And I think, but they can't be one line, just one liners. I think we have to organize it to happen. And I think that means, raising the idea, which is good that it's been put on the table, sort of raised as a one tactic that could be used, but then I think it has to be organized, and we have to explain to people why it will have some weight and power and leverage to it. And then, you know, I think in some ways there is enough spontaneous energy that many working class people will join it despite their relationship to their union, or if they're in no union at all, which of course most workers are not. But I also think the unions have a real role to play in terms of bringing infrastructure to it, in terms of shutting down key parts of the economy where there is strong unionization still, and give it some strength.
And do you think that Trump and the people, the fascists really, who support this, are going to try to use Minneapolis as an example?
In other words,
if you can crush Minneapolis, that you can go to, you know, Portland, you can go to Los Angeles, you can go to other cities and do the same thing?
Absolutely. I mean, that's clearly what's happening, is they want to draw a line. I can speculate as to why. You know, I think there's a lot of focus on the racism directed at the Somali community and at Ilhan Omar and that kind of stuff. And that's clearly an element of this, is just this racism directed at Somali people. And, you know, I think there's been a lot of sort of hatred drummed up against Somalia and Somali people for years in the U.S. But I also think it's not just about a kind of irrational white supremacy. It's also about trying to smash a community that, you know, that sacked the third precinct and sort of helped turn the country on its head after the lynching of George Floyd. And so I think there's an element of this that's about trying to, a kind of control and suppression of, the people, the organization, the spirit of Minneapolis. But I don't think it will work. I think right now it's really galvanizing people in the other direction, towards unity, towards, stepping out of your comfort zone to take action. At least that's been the character of things the last couple of weeks. So I assume that's going to continue today and going forward.
And I'm a member of the CWA, the News Guild, and the CWA has taken a position, Claude Cummings Jr., against this. The AFL-CIO has taken a position nationally. The unions nationally, most of them, with the exception of probably of the Teamsters, have said, have condemned this murder and said that this is an attack on the community. What more should the national unions be doing?
I mean, they should be treating this, like you said, an occupation, like a fascist or white supremacist attack on the city, and we should be organizing accordingly. So I think unions need to start figuring out all exactly what that means in terms of protecting its members, who may be especially vulnerable to ICE attacks and deportation. I think it means giving people capacity and education about what organizing a resistance network will look like. I think it will mean publicly calling for decisive action and not, sort of following around Democratic Party politicians and having them lead the way, because they don't lead us anywhere. And being a place where their members can get involved in the movement. I think there's a lot of people, for instance, in my workplace, other workplaces, where people see what's going on in the streets, or they see what's going on in social media and like to find a way to plug in. But, if they don't have any activist experience, it can be a little tricky at times. And I think unions can be one sort of gateway and organization for folks that want to get involved in this movement.
And do you think this situation in Minneapolis is connected to the attack on Venezuela, what's going on internationally? Because it seems that Trump is basically attacking countries all over the world, bombing Nigeria, saying he wants to occupy Greenland. I mean, it seems that there's no borders for him.
Yeah, and in addition to that, I would add that they're also, offering up Ukraine to Putin as part of this. I think, Trump's politics are, openly imperialist, openly white supremacist, and plundering, a grift and plundering. And I think that, in order to do that, they need to be able to control the people in the borders of the United States in order to effectively take these kinds of actions around the world. But yeah, it's all aimed at policing, suppressing, working class people and working class power, and and the sort of like power and money grab for the Trump regime in particular and his allies.
That was Minneapolis CWA President Kieran Knutson on the expanding ICE presence in Minneapolis and what working people, including organized labor, can do about it.
ICE, water frozen solid. ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE, El Hielo.
Va pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Cuando llegue la patrona que no se vuelva a quejar, no sea cosa que la acuse de ilegal. José atiende los jardines, parecen de Disneyland. Maneja una troca vieja sin la licencia. No importa si fue taxista allá en su tierra natal. Eso no cuenta para el tío Sam. Anda suelto por esas calles. Nunca se sabe cuándo nos va a tocar. Lloran los niños, lloran a la salida. Lloran al ver que no llegará mamá. Se queda allá, eso pasa por salir a trabajar.
That was La Santa Cecilia, ICE El Hielo. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. The Trump administration's attack on Venezuela is being seen as an attack on the working class of all Latin America. Maria Pele is a professor at the University of Buenos Aires, a member of the faculty union, and a supporter of the Workers' Party, which has representation in the Argentine parliament. She spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the view from Argentina and what they want to do to stop the attack.
We all know that the driving force behind this attack is not democracy or human rights, but the dispute over control of a strategic territory and the most largest oil reserves in the planet. Trump said it himself. The material content of the intervention is not about liberating Venezuelan people, but about reorganizing Latin American countries, state, and economy under the tutelage of the United States. And that is what the Monroe Doctrine they are talking about consists of. And it constitutes a severe blow to Latin American working class. Also, the USA aims to oust China from Latin America and advance its control over different areas of the Western Hemisphere, such as Greenland. And they want to put its backyard, Latin America, in order. And this is part of the global escalation of war, and it's a really declaration of war to working class in Latin America. We need to stand up, us as Partido Obrero, Workers' Party, and El Frente de Izquierda, the left front. We are calling for a general strike for the whole continent. We need to stand up the working class throughout the whole continent.
And the governments like Lula in Brazil, they're also under attack. If they can get away with this in Venezuela, what Trump has said is that China and Russia are not going to be able to operate in Latin America. That's going to be under the control of the United States. The role of social democracy and like Lula and other left governments in Colombia. How do you think they're going to be able to operate under these circumstances?
Well, you see, they have been really toned down their criticism. They condemned the attacks, but they have toned down their criticism, making it increasingly diplomatic. Petro is now forced to call to a mobilization that is going to happen this afternoon, I think at 4 p.m. But they are having a very low-tone speech about this. I think they are negotiating. They're not going to stand up for our sovereignty, and they're not going to stand up for Latin American working class. So it's really our job, workers, unions, to stand up. We need to have a very independent policy to mobilize and organize that general strike throughout the whole American continent.
And it seems that the United States is becoming more and more desperate economically. It can't compete with China, and it wants to stop countries of Latin America and Central America having any trade with China and other countries. Do you think that Trump is acting from a position of strength or a position of weakness?
Well, I think it's weakness, but I think it's the weakness coming from the economic capitalist crisis as a whole, because, well, it's a very hard to define specifically the things because they're moving all the time. But Trump said that the oil for China wouldn't be in a risk. And even Argentina, the Milei, the president of Argentina, said that they're not going to cut off the negotiations with China. I think the background of all this is the economic, the crisis of the capitalist economy. And it is from the weakness, but I'm not sure that like the United States is losing against China. I think that, like, well, in the escalation of the war, trying to reorganize and really have the control of different areas of the world. Now, we'll see. We'll see what's going on. But it's really from a weakness they're standing up.
And one of the things that happened recently in your election with Milei is that Trump said that they would give up to $40 billion to support the Milei government. Did that have any effect on the election in Argentina, the intervention of Trump and the U.S. capitalists in Argentina?
Well, yeah, it really did. It was a sort of extortion to the people and a very imperialist imposition that surely had something to do with the results of the election. The thing is that, as I said before, the economic capitalist crisis may not have Trump giving Milei all the money that he needs to go on with this very weak Argentinian economy that is maintaining inflation from going up. So everything is very fragile, I think. And even the support, the economic support that Trump is giving to Milei, is not going to last so long. And Argentina is in a really fragile place. That's why it's so important for us to organize working class here and in throughout the continent.
And you say that you're for a general strike of the people, the workers of Latin America. How do you see that taking place, and how are you organizing for it?
Well, the day of the attack, we gathered at the embassy. It was a very important concentration. And then on Monday, we had a very important demonstration with the participation of more than 50 grassroots organizations. Now we are talking about organizing a new one. And from the left front, we are trying to organize an event to, to talk about this problems. And we are calling as a whole to the unions to do something. It's really a political struggle too, because leadership is under the dominance of Peronism, and Peronism doesn't want people on the streets, because, you know, people on the streets in Latin America and in Argentina too may ignite anti-colonialist sentiment that is in conflict with the deals they also defend. So It's a political struggle, and we're going, you know, I'm part of a union from professors of the university, and we were on the concentrations, and we are up to a strike for that. We're going to call, we are also in a summer, in a summer break here in Argentina. So some of the unions are a little bit more deorganized as usual, but February will be a very important month in which we can make the meetings and start calling and organizing it.
What is the position of Milei on the U.S. intervention in Venezuela?
Oh, well, you know, he's such as Netanyahu's position. He, of course, he's with him. He is a very servile, like very shameful. He supports anything that Trump says or does. It's really shameful.
He's a Trump sycophant. A sycophant.
He's like his fan number one, I think, more than Netanyahu. It's so shameful, really.
And do you think that's going to lead to a backlash in Argentina?
It may. I think like times are accelerating, you know, and it's very, everything is so fragile. Economic structure of Argentina depending so much on the United States is so fragile. So it could really accelerate times of hatred to the government. I think it will. And I think Peronism will be able to, you know, to stop that from happening.
Well, when Milei originally took power, he said he was going to break off all relationships with China and stop the trade with China.
No, not only he didn't, but he reaffirmed their negotiations with China just yesterday, I think, after Trump said that China would have their oil. No.
So in the case of Argentina and in the case of Brazil, they can't afford to break off relations with China without...
They can't afford. See, I was thinking about the BRICS yesterday and how India, who's preceding the BRICS now, didn't condemn the attack. See, the economic negotiations between them are going on without any problems. No one seems to be, no government wants to seem to break relations, diplomatic relations or economic relations with nor China or the United States.
And the history of the fight against imperialism in Latin America,
yeah,
the Monroe Doctrine, long history of the United States controlling and exploiting and taking away the wealth of resources of Latin and Central America. The fact that you have now a ruler of the United States who basically says he wants to go back to the good old days, like he wants to go back to Confederacy in the United States, slavery,
yeah.
And is what is the feeling of people in Argentina and Latin America about an open expression that the United States wants to control your country and all the other countries of Latin America and Central America?
Yeah, it's really frustrating for a lot of us. But it's part of the history that we've been having after dictatorships in Argentina, I think. The 70s was a great moment for radical mobilization against colonialism in Argentina and in Latin America. Then the role of dictatorships and democracies after that were very strong to pacify the resistance of colonialism, I think. So the 90s was a time, the neoliberalism, a time where the United States definitely came to stay to this country. And then the popular rising in 2001 in Latin America, in Argentina, had a very anti-colonialist content. But then the years after, the transition, the democratic transition, was very, like in a pacifying way, to talk about, you know, business with the United States. But I believe that we're gonna turn that history and we're gonna go back to our real roots of anti-colonialism.
And the danger of that for U.S. imperialism, for Trump and U.S. imperialism, is that if the people of Latin America and Central America unite against U.S. imperialism, it could lead to the shutdown of embassies throughout Latin America. It could lead to the blockade of all U.S. ships and planes. They have the power to stop the United States and Latin America if they act together.
We are working for that. We need to work on that. And the whole action, you know, unite action, even with the working class of the United States, we need to unite actions and go for an international continental movement against this. We are working on that, and we believe that we're going to get to that eventually.
And the Italian Dock Workers Union, USB, have called for a general strike on February 6th. They're urging American longshore workers, ILW and ILA, to join them. And what they are saying is we need an international working class movement to fight imperialism, to fight the genocide in Gaza, to fight the attacks on the working class in Italy, the militarization of Europe and the United States. There's an unlimited budget for military when people can't get health care in the United States. When we're closing education, they're laying off education workers. It seems that the conditions are ripening, actually, for the unity of the world working class because of the attacks on all countries, all workers of the world.
Absolutely. We have to work on that. And that's a very good thing, the 6th of February. I think the situation is going to be very... It's going to be like a good soil to organize the unite the workers unite throughout the world. And it's a very good thing to be trying to organize this general strike throughout the world for the 6th of February.
That was Buenos Aires Professor Maria Pele speaking about what the people of Argentina think of the current Trump administration's attack on Venezuela and what they are doing to thwart U.S. attacks.
Esta mañana me he levantado. Oh, bella chao, bella chao, bella chao, chao, chao. Esta mañana me he levantado y he descubierto al invasor. Oh, partigiano, me voy contigo. Ciao, bella, ciao, bella, ciao, 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 partigiano, me voy contigo porque me siento aquí morir. Y si yo caigo en la guerrilla, oh, bella, ciao, bella, ciao, bella, ciao, 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 si yo caigo en la guerrilla te dejaré mi fusil. Cava una fosa en la montaña.
That was La Casa de Papel, Bella Ciao, Diego Moreno. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Next, we'll hear a discussion of new and extensive changes to the government-recommended childhood vaccine schedule announced by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on January 5, 2026. The new policy, effective immediately, is in line with 20 other countries' schedules, most closely with that of Denmark. Clayton Morris of the Redacted podcast interviewed Mary Holland, founder and CEO of Children's Health Defense.
Witnessing the largest rollback in childhood vaccines in history, thanks to RFK Jr. and the new rules coming out of the CDC today, it's already sending shockwaves across Washington. I love watching like a lot of liberals like really melt down over this, that think that we should be injecting our kids with all sorts of untested horrible things in our bodies. Like, just shove them. Go out and get as many COVID vaccines as you can. The CDC has quietly shrunk the routine childhood vaccine schedule by more than half. They took it down from 84 to 88 doses down to around 30. If I understand it correctly, we'll get some clarification on all of those numbers in a second. Several vaccines that were once recommended for all children are no longer considered routine, including COVID shots, thank God, annual flu vaccines, Hep A and B, rotavirus, meningococcal vaccines. Instead, many of these have now been shifted into weird categories like, well, not weird, but different, called the shared clinical decision making or limited to high risk populations. So I guess you consult with a doctor. They then said, maybe you should go and get one. Some vaccines remain on the schedule, though, like MMR, DTaP, polio, and chickenpox. But even here, we're seeing changes, including a reduction of the HPV vaccine, thank goodness, from 2 doses down to 1. Whether you see this as long overdue or maybe stunning reversal, one thing is clear. This is the largest rollback of routine child vaccinations in U.S. history, and it raises, you know, some serious questions, actually, about, like, what were parents told for decades? Were they lied to the whole time? To help us unpack what this actually means and why this is happening now, what families should understand, we're joined by Mary Holland. Mary is the CEO of Children's Health Defense, the author of Vaccine Epidemic, How Corporate Greed, Biased Science, and Coercive Government Threaten Our Human Rights, Our Health, and Our Children. Mary, great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So if these vaccines were truly settled science, as we were all told, then why is the CDC suddenly walking back more than half of these routine childhood scheduled vaccines? What changed? Was it the data or was it the politics?
Well, December 5th, the president put out a memorandum saying, CDC, you have to look at what other peer countries are doing, and you have to see whether we really have sort of the gold standards science behind our program. And so an assessment was done, and they came back and they said, we looked at 20 other countries, and no other country in the world had as many doses of as many vaccines with as poor health outcomes as we did. And so they looked at what other advanced countries, Denmark, Germany, France, other major countries, what they were doing. And to a significant extent, they aligned what we're doing now with other countries. And they're relying more on every vaccine, Clayton, is still available. Anybody who wants to get any of the vaccines that have previously been recommended are still available, and they will still be covered by insurance. But now, instead of having all of these vaccines being pushed on almost all children by pediatricians, they really won't be pushing the same number of vaccines on kids. And for high-risk groups or for the sort of more tangential vaccines that were basically only added in the last 15 years, it'll be shared decision-making. So it's going to be much easier for doctors to say, you don't need a hepatitis B shot, which children don't need. You don't need a hepatitis A shot. You don't need a meningococcal shot. Now, how is this going to affect the states is a key question. How is this going to affect liability in the event of vaccine injury is also an important question. You have to recognize that what happens is that the CDC recommends the vaccines, but the states mandate them. And what we're already seeing is this probably a huge division between the blue states and the red states. And the blue states are already saying, oh, we're not going to follow the CDC anymore. We're going to create our own schedule, and we're going to go with the old ACIP schedule. And that's going to raise a lot of really important new legal questions of, okay, well, if the CDC doesn't recommend it for routine administration, then query, and if it's not covered by the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, who's going to pay when a kid dies, or who's going to pay when a kid becomes blind or becomes unable to walk or develops some severe autoimmune condition, which all happen with vaccines. They're not all safe and effective. So this is a fabulous step. And one of the most important things, Clayton, is they're saying we still need to do the real science, because the real science has never been done. There's not a single vaccine on the childhood schedule that has ever been tested against a true inert placebo, which is a shocking revelation, but that's the truth. So this is a fantastic step. It's not, we're not there yet, but we're definitely on our way towards improving children's health by actually doing the science and pulling back on recommendations that genuinely have no science behind them.
I mean, we still haven't done the science. That's just, like, remarkable to me. So let's just inject our children here. Like, how damaging? You mentioned just some of the health side effects here. It's important for people when you're hearing, like, you know, blue states, red states, and then, like, parents and, you know, maybe who are blue, who live in a red state, are like, oh, that's it. We're moving to Minnesota because I want my kid to have 80 shots. Screw President Trump. I'm doing it. I want my kid to be filled up with as much mercury and whatever else. I want my kid to be autistic. I want my kid to, you know, have brain damage. I mean, I'm being a little hyperbolic here, but it's just so crazy to me as a parent that you would just go along with this. We were told during COVID, listen to the CDC. Now they're saying, we're not going to listen to the CDC.
I think that COVID played an incredibly instrumental role here, because I think COVID and the shots that didn't work and the shots that were so injurious caused a great deal of skepticism. And so after that period through 2024, I think CDC is really empowered to say, you know what, we're going to be transparent with you. We're going to tell you we don't have gold standard science on any of the vaccines, but we definitely don't have it on these Hep A, Hep B, meningococcal, influenza, rotavirus, COVID that we've been telling you to take and give to your children. I don't think a lot of parents, blue state parents in red states, are going to move back to blue states to give their kids the vaccines. Every single vaccine, Clayton, is still available throughout the country. It is.
Yeah, it's a great point.
It might be a little harder to get, but it's still going to be covered by insurance. It's still going to be covered by Medicaid. It's going to be covered by the CHIP program. So I don't think that there's any cause for parents to leave red states. The bigger issue, as you probably know, is that parents in some states like New York, where I am, have no opt-out from vaccines. If they don't want to give them, you basically end up homeschooling. And that is a very important legal issue that we're deeply involved in at Children's Health Defense.
Is there concern inside the public health establishment, like long-term outcomes?
Listen, pharma and its proxies are up in arms, and they are already suing HHS, right? The American Academy of Pediatrics is already suing Kennedy and HHS for what they've already done. Surely they're going to add this into their woes. Doctors are skeptical. But the real science that has been done, Clayton, shows that unvaccinated children are healthier. Children with fully developed, intact immune systems can deal with something like chickenpox or measles. I'm old enough that, you know, those were routine illnesses, and there were not thousands of children dying from these things. That's a fabrication. That's a fraud. There were a couple hundred kids who were dying, and there are much better treatments now. And so I think we're going to come, I pray, we're going to come to a new equilibrium to understand the potential benefits, but also the real risks of vaccines. And those real risks have been so suppressed. They've basically sidelined any doctors who talked about them. They've made it impossible in the media that's pharma funded to talk about real hazards from vaccines. So we're at a new beginning, and it's exciting.
You mentioned children are better off and healthier without these vaccines. I mean, that should just reverberate.
That's what the science. Yeah. That's just what the science shows. You know, they haven't done the placebo-controlled trials, as HHS is saying. They haven't been looking at the long-term health outcomes. Who cares whether you get measles or not? What people really care about is, are you healthy when you're 15? Are you healthy when you're 30? Are you healthy when you're 55? That's what normal people care about. It's the objectives have been so reductionist, right? Oh, you know, how many cases of measles? How ridiculous is that as an overall metric for health? It doesn't matter.
Right. Can you get measles and just bounce back? Can you get chicken pox? And just like I had chicken pox as a kid, and who cared? I was, you know, bounce back. Who cares?
Right.
Just like, I mean, look at the Amish children, the Amish community, right? I mean, nothing in there, right? And so one of the healthiest populations in the country, if
Correct.
I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
So I guess what I'm asking—
No autism, Clayton. I just want to add a footnote of one of the early studies done by a very important journalist in the space. No cases of autism in, you know, a huge Amish community.
That's a nice little footnote. Just like a little side footnote, I mean, because the cases of autism in the United States have absolutely exploded, and we don't know, can we pinpoint it directly on the massive increase in childhood vaccination schedules, up to 88 shots? Do we have the clear evidence yet? I mean, the White House, obviously.
We have a lot of it. You know, we have a lot of evidence. We don't have, you know, there's not one cause to autism. There's not one cause to other neurological injuries. But we definitely know that autism, which is now 1 in 31 children, has exploded during the time that this vaccine schedule has ramped up just incredibly. And I don't know if, you know, I don't want to go too deep, but in 1986, Congress passed the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which basically gave blanket liability protection to the pharmaceutical industry and to the healthcare practitioners. So if kids die, if kids get injured, they don't have to deal with it. There's not going to be a malpractice suit. There's not in real life. There's not going to be a failure to warn suit. There's not going to be a defective design suit. They just can add, and it's billions of dollars. Any vaccine that is basically foisted on a cohort of children, 4 million children, has billions of dollars right there. So the incentives have all been in one direction, which has been financial incentives. The incentives in the vaccine program has not been health of children.
No, they need to reverse that immediately. I don't know if there's any support, what sort of support we have in Congress to get rid of that 1986 law. What do you think?
Not enough, not a lot, but I think it's growing, Clayton. And I there are some really fantastic members in the House and the Senate that, yeah, you know, that we think really highly of, who definitely get this issue.
So I guess, and I was bringing up the Amish piece of this and your point about the healthier, you know, the science showing that children without vaccines are healthier long term. So when these individuals then want to sue HHS and they want to sue Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you're going to have to, and this goes to trial, you're going to have to go through discovery. You're going to have to go, we're actually going to get to hear the science. So how will, what leg from a legal perspective would they have to stand on if the science isn't on their side?
Well, the difficulty is that for 50 years, while all of this is ramped up, we've been relying on this authority, right? The people in the white coats, the white coated priesthoods. And that's what has always been relied on in the disputes that we've had so far. Well, I'm following the CDC schedule. I'm following the American Academy of Pediatrics. I think we're about to see the truth come out, Clayton. I think that AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, may be surprised at what they wished for, because they are going to have to put forward the science, and they don't have the science. And that's why people like Dr. Paul Offit, the most prominent spokesperson for the vaccine schedule and for vaccines in the United States, they will never agree to debate anyone. Secretary Kennedy for 15 years has been saying, I will debate anybody. I'm a lawyer. I believe in debate. I believe in adverse positions and erring differences. No one will agree to debate him. I hope that while he's the secretary, some person is going to come and agree to debate him. But I'm not going to hold my breath. But I agree with you that these lawsuits now being brought by the American Academy of Pediatrics are going to show the truth, which is that the emperor has no clothes.
I would love to watch that debate. It'd be more entertaining than a Mike Tyson fight. Mary, I get you out of here on this. Epidemiologist and administrator at the McCullough Foundation, a friend of the show, Peter McCullough, one of his colleagues, Nicholas Holscher, he posted this. He said, you know, however, this decision does not fully end the problem, meaning this rollback. The vaccines that remain routine are still largely untested, are administered during critical periods of neurodevelopment in children, and increase risk of over 20 chronic diseases, including autism. Anything you disagree with there?
No, I don't disagree with the thing. And I have high regard for Nick and for Peter McCullough. And no, what is still on the schedule from our perspective should not be, our view at Children's Health Defense is there should be no medical mandates. It should be between you and your healthcare practitioner, and all medicine should be in the interest of the individual patient. It is not something, there's never going to be a drug, there's never going to be a vaccine that is equally effective and equally safe for all people. We've been living with this mythology that really it's time for it to end.
Can I ask you just a quick legal question? Like in the state of New York, like if I'm a parent,
yeah,
and I've got my kids and I don't want them to get these mandated shots so that they can go to the elementary school that I pay property taxes for. Like, have any of these gone to trial at a level?
Oh, Clayton, we've been fighting in New York since before COVID, and we've certainly amped up the fight since COVID. In 2019, the religious exemption was revoked in New York State. Medical exemptions have become exceedingly difficult to get, and Children's Health Defense has been funding litigation in New York State to get real medical exemptions, get real religious exemptions since 2018. And I have to say, we've made a lot of progress, and I believe that we are on the cusp of some major legal changes that will enable people anywhere in the country to have real medical exemptions and real religious exemptions. But what Kennedy and HHS are doing here absolutely supports that. And it's the idea that the recommendation from the federal government is that these things require shared decision making. That's going to open up a lot more space for doctors of integrity and courage to say, no, this child should not get a second MMR dose because they had an adverse reaction to the first one. Right now, Clayton, we're dealing with a case right now. I mean, kids are being injured because of the cruel orthodoxy in New York, literally.
That was Children's Health Defense CEO Mary Holland speaking to Clayton Morris of the Redacted podcast about recent controversial and consequential revisions to the CDC's childhood vaccine schedule. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Seltzer and Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.